From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
That would be moi and Andrew Goss, who's the good friend and the currency historian and the man about town who is the star of the show every Wednesday, and I'm going to cough, but that's okay because I got something in my throat, is Andrew Goss, and he is in New Jersey. Good morning, Mr. Goss.
Good morning, Patrick.
What's up there, Doc? What's up? What's up with you?
Nah, spring in the Garden State. What do you know?
Spring in the Garden State.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to be on the show, you can do the 800 number, which is actually 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Andrew Goss is a currency historian. Two books, Secret World of Money. Uncle Sam Cooks the books, working on his third, Monetary History of the United States. He buys and sells gold coins for a living. Has a company up there in Hawthorne and also in Hilton Head, and been in the biz about 35 years or so. And you sell numismatic coins, not chunks of gold and stuff like that. So
not a bullion man.
So people cannot just take the gold out of their teeth and send it to you and trade it.
No, there are plenty of people that do that.
I know they do. Here,
you know, lots of scrap gold buyers and sellers of bars and bricks and blocks of physical gold.
Mm-hmm.
It's available. They dig it out of the ground every day,
every day.
And strike it into different forms, although there have been some problems lately in some of the refineries where purity's called into question, integrity.
I'm shocked. I'm just shocked.
What I deal in are antique American gold and silver and copper to a certain extent. Nickel.
Antiques,
yes. Antiques. The coins that have a fixed, limited supply that is, in fact, suffering from attrition. People tend to not treat their collectibles well. So especially those who don't realize what they have, they tend to deteriorate as time goes on. And so those that are saved in pristine condition, why, they just continually become more desirable.
Yeah, they do. Well, we talk about a lot of cool things about what money is and what it isn't. Gold, silver, oil, geopolitics, how it's all tied in, debt. And so I flipped over my little perpetual calendar of precious quotes seconds before turning on my microphone.
Ah.
So this is unplanned, and here's what it says. So
Go. So
I'm just going to throw this one to you. I'm going to throw it in your court in the financial sector. Sometimes you have to just face the lion because there's no reason to run from it. Mm. Isn't that good? That's a nice spiritual quote. So in the financial world,
yes.
What would the lion be?
Well, the lion is the elephant in the room, right? The fact that there is no substance behind
your money. Oh, no. Really? You're going to go right there, right?
Right. Well, that's what it is.
What does it
matter if you accumulate wealth and you build accounts of money, what you call money, and you have no idea or concept of what a dollar is? If you don't know what a dollar is, boy, that lion, you've turned your back on him.
Would be the lion that you have to face.
Yeah.
Otherwise, but if you run from it and just
Stick
your head in the sand and play video games and watch Stairway to the Stars.
And hope, yeah, we hope.
What do you risk doing that?
Well, you risk your entire existence, really,
when
you boil it down. Now, that's that black swan event that the collapsitarians and the crashaholics warn us about. You'll get a newsletter, you'll get a video, somebody will send you a link. It's, the world is coming to an end on this date specific because of this event. And you'll be running through the streets. The dollar will be worthless. There'll be no means of commerce possible except barter. And for that reason, you should sell everything you own and buy gold or silver.
I can remember when I first met you in the early 90s, there certainly was those people out there. Of course, this was like just pre-interweb, before Al Gore invented it.
Mm.
So we didn't really get a lot of it except in newsletters. You know, that kind of thing, right?
Seminars,
you get these things in the mail, and you open them up and say, well, the dollar's going to crash,
gold
is going to be $5,000 and buy now. And, you know, that's been, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. So that's been going on probably for a long time, right? These people, the crashaholics.
Well, you know, rightly so. When President Nixon closed the gold window in 1971.
Yeah, good for Dick.
You think of monetary, the monetary circumstances between 71 and the and let's say 80, which is really a good window to look through.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a dollar when the window was closed that was effectively pegged at $40.22 per ounce. And slowly and surely, the value of the dollar as it floated against gold just deteriorated. It lost half its value in 3 years, and then another third in three more years. And it was appearing to many. In fact, I recall James Blanchard and the National Conference on Monetary Reform. There were some serious calls out there for a total revamp of the monetary system. That the fiat thing just wasn't working.
And what year was it?
Well, this is in 1972, 73,
just 74, after the gold window
75,
thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Each succeeding year, the dollar was worth slightly less. So here you're out there working, and you're earning the same salary as you were before, and the same number of dollars are coming into your bank account, but yet somehow the ends don't meet anymore. And while you weren't looking, effectively Congress, and with the president's executive order, move the ends. So the substance of what a dollar was taken away. And so now we had no clue from that point forward how many dollars in circulation versus how much gold we had. We really had no measure. So there were people calling right up until Ronald Reagan took office under him. He gave us the first silver coin in, goodness, first circulation, I'd say 50. 1954, so 1982, okay, so a good solid 30 years since we had a silver coin, and Ronald Reagan gave us a half dollar. Ronald Reagan gave us a half dollar with George Washington on it in 1982 that was made of 90% silver, met the standard of what a silver dollar was, or silver half dollar. It was coin, silver, 90% silver. And when you have that physical measure in your hands, then there's nothing that can be done to dilute it. And if you change it, you have to change it in public. So that's what was lost when the gold window was closed in 1971.
Well, it looks like, just big picture, thinking about it this morning, that you're going to be turned out to be kind of a smarty pants, and I know you're not going to be an I told you so guy, so we're thankful for that. But, I mean, there's nothing that I see as I scan and prep for the show, Andrew, each week, around the world with the central banks and the amount of money that they're creating. And I think it's been about, I think it's almost $7 trillion, isn't worldwide this year already?
Yeah.
And
Fortunately, the Chinese are deleveraging, right? They're not playing into it, but it's really hurting them dramatically. If they reverse course and start re-leveraging, it could get as bad again as it, or much worse, I suppose.
Oh, sorry, I misquoted myself. It's a $7 trillion, I think, since the crisis. $1 trillion in 2017, but we've only done 4 months, so January, March, April. So they got $20 trillion. They're tracking, they're tracking 3.5, right? Annualized central banks, if you look at the GDP aggregate balance sheets, central banks around the world percentage to GDP, you know, that looks ugly.
Just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah, it just keeps getting bigger. So it looks as if. If you would look at, say, monetary creation, Article 1, Section 8 notwithstanding, that the people that are on the cocaine, they're just doing more. They're just not going to go to meetings and stop, are they?
Great analogy. Yeah. They can manage this.
I can manage this. I can go to work. I'm good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah.
Good. You know, kids are fine.
Right.
You know?
I'm
a functioning addict.
That's right. A functional addict. We all know them. And no doubt, the best ones are running the central banks.
That's right.
And with all deference to the crashaholics and the collapsitarians, the risk is out there. It's sort of like, you don't know it. There's been a good commercial for a brokerage house where some guy starts giving financial advice and, do you trust me? Yeah, I trust you. Well, great, because I'm a DJ. And he rips off his outfit.
Is that right?
I think it's FINRA, the financial the standards board for the brokers, so they tell you to check your broker and so forth. But this is essentially what we do with the central banks. If we understood the degree of risk that they were taking in our name, we would
freak out as users of dollars.
Yeah, we would freak out, especially people that live debt free, pay their debts off early, save their money.
Right, I get it.
Yeah, those folks, if they knew what risk they were taking without knowing, and this has really been the central bank's thesis for a great many years. You know, I talk about how in the mid 19th century, if you said, "Well, that's like money in the bank." Mm-hmm. Well, then whoever you were talking to knew that that meant there's risk. You're telling me that that's a risky proposition if you say it's like money in the bank.
Well,
here we are in the 20th century where people view that as, that's the safest thing it can be, you know, money in the bank.
And if you imagine when you go to work, there's always a juggernaut somewhere of something that's pushing against or the challenge that you have facing you, right?
Risk.
Either cutting risk, either you have to pare back on your expenses. You
yes.
have to get more sales to make
yeah.
things all
mm-hmm.
work.
Yep.
In the central bank world where you are banks of issues, you know, at the end of the day, you have a few scotches and you just crunch all you want and you just create more
make
money.
More.
I mean, you know, it doesn't...
Okay, now understanding that as we do,
yeah.
now it's the injection point that makes all the difference in the world.
Where... The new Cheetos, Fritos come out.
Correct.
So you crunch some at night after your scotch, and then what are you saying?
Where they are injected.
Well, aren't they injected into mortgages, into stocks? I mean, into banks borrow money?
Think of the differences if you inject it, let's say, into student debt relief.
Okay.
Right?
The $1.4 trillion that they're going to probably just monetize and pay off.
Yeah.
Someday.
Right. So who are you bailing out then? The banks that underwrote it, the individuals that took them, you know, you're
I'll
showing
pick D, all of the above.
And you're showing favor to that class of people.
The millennials, yeah.
At the expense of perhaps another class of people.
Mm-hmm.
So the injection point where the new money enters circulation makes all the difference in the world. And the von Mises people, the libertarians, have an adage in a fiat society, whoever spends the money first gets the best use out of it.
Because after you spend it, then it's actually diluted.
It loses its potency.
Right.
Because
it
dilutes the rest of the supply. I think on my audio tape, I do the analogy of a bunch of people coming over and you've got an urn of coffee and you just keep adding water because, you know, you have more people
yeah,
coming in.
Yeah, this coffee's
in.
A little...
it's a little weak, and it just gets weaker and weaker, but it looks like coffee. It sort of tastes like coffee.
Still is coffee.
It's coffee, really, but it's very weak. And so this is what's happening to your dollar while you save them and paying your debts off early, especially in the case of mortgage debt. That's the cheapest money you'll ever find.
Yeah.
And if you don't deploy that money in addition to the house that you mortgaged, so you know you have two assets appreciating in value, at least you have a hope of keeping ahead of the inflation juggernaut, because it just appears to me that there's a great deal of money to debt to monetize, a great deal of P, right? Potential money that could enter circulation and just wreak havoc on the value of the dollar.
Now, on the flip side of the mortgage side, I've heard plenty of friends of mine and people over the years that say, yeah, I get what Andy's saying, but, you know, I really want to pay off my mortgage.
Don't get it.
So I'm not beholden to anybody because here's what they say now.
Yeah.
In case something really bad happens,
yeah.
at least I know that I'm going to have a place to live.
That's not true.
Oh?
Don't pay your taxes. Don't pay your insurance.
Yeah, but that's only what $3,000-$5,000 a
Doesn't
year.
Doesn't matter. Don't pay them and see what happens. Let's say something really bad does happen,
and you can't.
And
you lose your job, and you can't get to work.
You can't pay. Yeah, now you can't pay your taxes. So who are you beholden to? Do you really own that house, or are you kind of just renting it?
I would think Hays County, where I live, gonna knock on your door.
Yeah, and take your house.
Hello.
And sell it.
And hello.
Okay, so. Now, think of it in these terms. So you work hard as you possibly can, and you pay off your mortgage, and then something catastrophic befalls you. You're no longer able to work, and your asset is your home. What do you do then? Sell it? You go to the bank and say, I'd like to borrow some of this equity back, and they say, well, you're sick. You can't work.
But
Why would we loan
But I guess they figure out if it got that bad, And if I went to and worked at McDonald's or Starbucks, at least I could still have my home.
But you're unable to. Something catastrophic has befallen you, and you're unable to do anything.
Oh, you're unable to do anything.
You're unable.
No, that's not good.
Yeah, you're unable. So now you approach the bank to borrow money. No, not going to do that. Not going to give you money. What's your income? None.
No.
Zero.
No.
Well, think of how much more comfortable you'd be if you had the equity stripped to the bone in that puppy, and you had it sitting in a checking account or some other liquid asset that you could tap into and...
I'll make your mortgage payment.
Maintain your existence, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point...
I mean, if that money was working for you...
Already,
I mean, you'd
yeah.
still be dipping in there to make your mortgage payment.
Of course you
but
would.
But is that even sustainable?
Well, is it sustainable?
I mean, it's sustainable, I guess, if you're making enough every month on the money to make mm-hmm. the mortgage payment.
Well,
is that correct?
Even if you're going negative, Patrick, it depends upon your tax situation.
Mm.
So I know a great many young people, successful young people,
yeah.
who do exactly that, pay their mortgages off as quickly as they can.
Right.
And so now we have a husband and wife, a couple that are working. They've put off having children, and they're in their mid-30s, and their mortgage is paid. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
But now they have no deductions, and they're in a tax bracket that chokes them. So it's like, okay, you're not paying interest, then you'll pay taxes.
And it looks as if, Andrew, that regardless of how simple they make the tax thing, if they get it done, that
that's
the mortgage,
the deduction
the
that
mortgage
stays.
Interest is going to stay, right?
That's the one that stays.
And they do that because housing really drives a lot of the economy, and they don't want to squash that.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
It does. And resort real estate also is a great. So for that council, for that couple,
yeah.
You know, mid-30s to early 40s, that has done this, has bulk paid their mortgage down
mm-hmm.
at a time when interest rates are historic lows, at a time when you should be loading up on mortgage interest. What's my counsel to those folks? Well, it is, hey, strip the equity from this house, take that cash and buy another productive investment. Buy yourself a beach house.
And rent
buy
it out
yourself
to me?
Rent it out. Exactly. Buy yourself an investment property. If real estate is what makes you happy, I'm just a little nervous about overbulking with real estate. But I certainly have my own real estate. And as I've said on past shows, 85% of my money is in gold and silver coin, American rare coin. But the other 15%, real estate's at the top of the list.
Could you even, is it even a doable thing to say, take that money out of your house that you paid off, buy a piece of rental real estate
sure.
outside or even inside the city where you live and have somebody else manage it for you?
Yeah.
Can you
yeah,
still
they,
make
and
money
they even
doing
have
that?
These
I guess.
Real estate investment trusts. But, you know, until you have your second home in a resort area that's easily rented.
That's what you like, huh?
Yeah.
In other
I
words,
like
something...
It.
In the Florida's, South Carolina,
yeah,
these kind of places.
Yeah, something on the Florida coast, something yeah. close to the water, something close to golf, something on a mountain
Hawaii
lake,
would
something
be good,
in a resort. Hawaii, yeah,
man.
Well, good luck buying there, but
yeah,
you get
I
the
know.
Point.
Yeah.
And something close to where you live. Like, where do you go when you take off for the summer and go on vacation? Well, everybody else goes there, too. And what you should do is buy that second piece of, because you're allowed to have your second home.
Do you write that interest off, too?
Yes, you can.
Really? I didn't
yes,
know that.
Yes, you can.
Really?
Yes.
That's pretty mm-hmm. cool.
So your second home, kind of like your first home, and your ability to make, so until you're maximizing those deductions, I don't think I would look at a third rental commercial, you know, where you're a landlord and somebody else is a tenant. And if you must, then you look at the real estate investment trusts. But I would urge people to stay away from commercial brick and mortar stores, big box stores and things like that. The market is overcrowded with capacity because we're still in that phase where, you know, you put your goods in a store and people come and look at them and then pay you and you pay rent and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
As that business model evaporates, the demand for that sort of space will evaporate.
Boy, it's evaporating pretty quickly, too.
Right? Right.
Sears is right at the top, huh?
But yeah. warehouses,
oh,
warehouse
yeah.
space.
That's what people like.
Right, as the Amazons and the Targets and the Kmarts shift to this a distribution model that involves you calling them up and saying, send me a pair of 30-30
Hager
jeans.
They're all going to that, right?
Right.
Walmart's
right.
trying to do it. You know,
right,
do it.
Right, yeah. right. Mm-hmm. So as that model makes the shift, the need for the brick and mortar shopping center type real estate is lessened, but the need for warehouse space is heightened. And same thing with the demographic, as people are gravitating to the low end of the wage scale, the chasm between the haves and the have-nots is getting wider. I was curious as to how many new millionaires. Did we talk about that last week?
No, I don't think so. No.
I got this amazing statistic that we make 1,500 new millionaires in the United States every single day.
1,500?
Every day.
And what's the definition for a millionaire?
$1 million in net worth.
Net worth. So, oh, okay. Yes. So that would be, you mean your home? But, oh, your home minus what you owe on it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Your net worth, $1 million. So, net worth. Point is, the number of poor people is legendary, right? So the chasm between the haves and the have-nots is getting wider, and you have more people having more. And I believe the count was 11 million millionaires in the United States. So I think it was 1 in 236. Mitchell did the numbers for me. Thank you, Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And so one person in every 236 in the United States is a millionaire. And we're minting 1,500 new ones every day. So, you know, those folks are going to be there. It's not like the class of folks that spend money and have are going to disappear. We may widen the gap in that the middle class disappears, and you're either on the bottom or the top, nothing in the middle. That's certainly the way it looks.
Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, it's The Real World of Money, and it's May 10th, 2017. If you'd like to be on the show, come on in and join us, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Going back to the central banks and the cocaine thing, if you look on this graph, Andrew, with the balance sheet in percentage of GDP, does that mean for their country, right? Let's see. Is that
correct?
Okay.
Yeah.
So actually the Fed is one of the best.
That's right.
They're
That's
one of the best.
Exactly. Restraint. Remarkable restraint.
Then it goes up from there. ECB, PBOC, which is,
People's Bank of China.
Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and then SNB. Who's them? Swiss National Bank?
Yes.
Wow. I thought these guys were bankers, man.
They are.
They're up to nearly 40% of GDP and their balance sheet. Now, talk to us about what is that? What's really going on with that? That seems like a big number, but I don't really understand.
Well, the Swiss understand the competition. And so if you recall, and we'd have to dig in the archives, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was a circumstance where people were going to Switzerland, dumping off their euro, and taking Swiss francs back to...
It was only about 3 years ago.
Was it three?
Yeah. Okay. And that's when they pulled it off, right? They pulled off the peg, correct?
Right. So their choice is stark. They're a prudently managed country. And so their choice is, okay, we do nothing and we allow the demand for our currency to cause it to rise in value,
right?
Which kills our tourism.
Yeah, because he wants to go and buy $12 for a burger, right?
Or chocolate.
Swiss chocolate.
Or a Swiss watch.
That'd be 20 bucks.
Yeah.
So
they say, well, then what we'll do is go along with the madness, but theirs is not out of... need. Theirs is for competitive protection. So what they store that extra Swiss franc in is what makes all the difference in the world. So if the people came in with euros and said, okay, we want to turn these euros into Swiss francs, and they said, great, I'll print you up some Swiss francs and I'll hold on to your euros.
Oh, so that's what they do.
Right.
That's
whereas
why
the other
got
banks
so
are
much on their balance
we're broke,
sheet.
We owe people so much money, we need to print more. And so the Swiss, being as smart as they are in terms of banking.
Yeah, they get it.
Yeah, but what are they buying?
I don't know.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They take a look at the Swiss in the gold markets, and you'll see that they have always understood what money is. Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution says, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. For 5,000 years, gold has been money. Yeah, I know. I keep bringing it. Yeah. Gold is money. Gold is money. Everything else is debt. So from the perspective of the Swiss, they are not keeping that money parked in euros. They're spreading it around so that they can convert back when people decide that they don't want those Swiss francs anymore. They want to dump them on the market and take home their whatever their local currency is.
So let's see. I sell $1 billion worth of sulfur. And I have a billion...
Input cost. You have input cost.
Yeah, but say I have $1 billion that I don't know what to do with. So I go over to Switzerland and I say...
Give me Swiss francs.
I want to buy... I want to trade you my billion Federal Reserve notes for Swiss francs.
Yes.
They create the Swiss francs?
Correct.
Because what I'm giving them is a debt instrument.
Correct.
Oh. So they can monetize the dollar too.
Sure they can.
Because it's a debt instrument.
That's right.
Okay. So I give them my billion from sulfur sales. Thank you very much, you sulfur users. Yep. And they give me a what is it, 80 cents? Or I don't know what it is. I don't know what the Swiss conversion is today, but I could look at it.
You could.
I could, but whatever. So they give me whatever the Swiss dollars are in relation, correct?
Yes.
So now what happens? So that's why their balance sheet is getting bigger.
Correct.
Because people like, why would I even want a Swiss franc rather than a Federal Reserve note?
Well, because you think it's going to hold its value better than the Federal Reserve note is.
Because they are more into gold and blah, 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 and all that stuff.
Whatever
you believe. They're Swiss bankers. And I saw in a movie one time, Tom Cruise, you should have a Swiss bank account, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. Yeah. All right, so you just think that Swiss is better,
Swiss
so you buy it.
They're financial people. They understand money management. So I'm going to go buy Swiss francs.
Okay, I'm with you.
Used to be pegged entirely to gold, you know.
Right, Well, when did they get off the gold thing? The gold thing.
They sort of drifted off right behind everybody else because it's difficult to maintain that standard. Because then,
if you were the only one, everybody, they'd be buying their stuff like crazy.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If you have a true open source currency, but see, this is I don't know how we've made this transition comfortably. This to me, I cannot understand it. You know, I show somebody a little gold coin from 1870, and it's one of 20, and it's worth 50,000 Federal Reserve notes.
Yeah.
And they look at my coin, and I have a hard time understanding how it holds that value. A novice, right?
Yeah, just a little coin.
I have a hard time understanding. Yeah.
What's what
I'm going to trade my 50,000 Federal Reserve notes for this $5, $2, $3, whatever it is.
What are you, crazy?
Yeah.
What are you, nuts? I mean, he's got like six zeros here. I'm not giving that to a little coin.
Right. And they don't see the value.
Sure.
And so for me, it's the opposite. I don't see the value in your Federal Reserve notes. I don't understand how you're comfortable holding those. You're asking me how I'm comfortable holding this one of 10 thing or one of 5 thing, and you're holding one of... How many quadrillion? I can't even keep up anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
So my friend the astronomer says, no, you can't call them astronomical numbers anymore.
Hmm.
You got to call them economical numbers now. Those are the big numbers. You know, distances to stars and things, those are...
Nothing,
Nothing now. Yeah. you guys in the financial world have surpassed us. And so, you know, I've talked about the pizza. Imagine... Same with the coffee. You order up a pizza and 10 people show up. Well, you need to make those slices a little smaller. But everybody still gets a slice.
I had a slice of pizza at Andy's house.
You get a slice. Yeah, everybody got a slice. So by making the dollar smaller or the Swiss franc smaller or the euro smaller or the Chinese yuan smaller.
Get more pieces.
More pieces to pass out. And from the perspective of the crowd, if everyone operates in unison... then you cannot see the game.
This is why they get together.
Correct.
And they meet to G12, to E7, whatever, G28. And they get a plan.
We're going to do this. You do that. Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. See, break. Mm-hmm. And then they hit the field.
Break. How many are you going to print this week? Well, I don't know.
All right. So should I buy them? No, you should sell them. What should I? You know, they operate with each other. So the idea that the Swiss National Bank doesn't talk to the Fed or doesn't talk to the ECB.
They do.
Is insane. Yes, not only do they talk, but they coordinate and they map their activities in such a way that there is no way to discern. You know, think of those three guys falling out of the airplane again. They all look at each other. Hey, we're all in the same shape, right? We're all equal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're plummeting towards the ground, but from your individual perspective, you're all in the same place. And that's where our monetary system has devolved, where there are no Swiss gold-backed currencies left. There just are none.
Yeah. So this is one of the reasons why Gaddafi can say, well, I think we should
have a gold dinar.
I think we should sell our oil for gold.
Yeah.
And then we should do this bourse, and we're going to get together with Saddam across the river whatever, and the Turks, and we're going to do this bourse, and we're going to have a gold-backed dinar. And because we don't like this debt thing anyway, it's against the Quran and you know, interest, and let's just do this. Yeah. And then, whoops, all of a sudden...
Oh, wow, what happened to your country, dude? Whoops.
Hey, dude, what happened?
Oh, man, it's a revolution. You ought to go deal with that.
You really think that's what goes on?
Do I think that's what goes on?
I know, you do.
That is funny.
That's what you taught us.
That is what goes on.
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, just look at history. It's all you have to do.
All you got to do.
You study history. That's all. And then ask yourself, oh, well, did we stop? We stopped doing this? Or did we just continue and, in fact, amplify the scale? So that was my belief. Forgive me, President Trump. I'd love to still believe you're that wide-eyed idealist. But you've been talked to. You understand the way the game is played and what you have to do. And you'll do it. That's, you know, when the big picture comes around, as George C. Scott said in the movie The Formula, in banking, we're all Swiss. So when you were running for president, you could be the biggest renegade you want. Now that you are the president, you're Swiss, baby. And at the end of the day, you have to do what has to be done, or they have to do what has to be done. And it's really not a good choice when it goes that way.
So what you're suggesting is
alluding to
this entanglement with dollars and war and gold and oil.
It rises above
it's
politics.
You could put the Dalai Lama in there and he'd probably,
he's going to do what he has to do.
He'd probably take the blue pill, you know?
Yes.
Well, you know, because that's his only choice, right?
Well, he has another choice,
but
it's not pleasant.
It's not a pleasant choice.
No.
You think it's that rough at that level? It must be.
Well, I do.
It must be.
It is, and I do.
It must be.
You know, you go ahead and study the Lincoln assassination, the McKinley assassination, the Garfield assassination, the Kennedy, Mm-hmm. You put the study to those and then use that lawyer attitude. Who benefits? Who benefits? Who benefits? And in every one, you know, in the case of Abe Lincoln, those were the first greenbacks. So if we've gone over in the first segment, Patrick, the idea that whoever gets to print this money, create this money, they're the real power in a society, right?
Yeah.
Knowing what we know. And the idea that the people should somehow benefit from this power, well, that's socialist. So in the presidential model where, all right, we're going to use an unbacked currency. And it's not going to be backed by dollars, and it's just going to be a debt instrument. It's just going to be a note, and it's just going to be created at whim. Well, then why doesn't or shouldn't the government create it in the name of the people, the way it's done in China? And the answer is because it's a very profitable business, creating, you know, $100 bills for 2 cents each. It's very profitable.
This whole thing is silly enough.
Yeah.
When the government is creating the dollars, that's, you know, but now.
At least there's no interest.
Now the government borrows it from
Correct.
The bankers.
And that's the central banker
first
model.
First time I learned that from you 25 years ago, I just go, what?
Yeah.
Come on.
So. Congress can only issue a bond or a bill or a note subject to some random debt limit. And this IOU that they issue is interest-bearing. And so they hand the IOU to the central bank, and this is the same in Germany and in France and England, all the major developed
EU,
countries.
Every place but China, right?
Everywhere but China.
Yeah. Wow.
And so.
You think they have an advantage?
The bank, the central bank, then creates the paper money or the electronic money to represent that bond and hands it over to Congress to spend into circulation. So now the Fed or the central bank, previously having nothing at all, now has a bond that bears interest.
And we, the people, are paying the interest.
Correct. Yeah. And repaying the principal.
And the Fed, I guess they got $2.5 trillion. They don't really even care if they ever get paid the principal because they created the money in the first place.
That's
so what do they
care? They don't.
Yeah.
So you guys their balance sheet balances. Yeah. So I issued all these treasury bonds. I issued all these Federal Reserve notes for somebody's pile of treasury bonds. Now, that diluted the value of Federal Reserve notes already in circulation. So if you had money in the bank, the moment they do that, you lose a fraction of what you have. So your dollar now becomes 97 cents in reality. But in perception, it still says a dollar on it. The numbers on the statement are still the same. But by buying that pile of treasury bills, bonds, or notes, they've put additional money into circulation. And so originally, the way that if you think the guns or butter logic was, if Congress issues a bond and I buy it and you buy it, or somebody with money sitting around buys it, well, that takes money out of circulation. And that keeps the balance. And if Congress spends too much, they choke off the economy. So this idea of checks and balances built into the Constitution with a monetary system that prevented the stealing of your wealth through these subterfugal means. This, we've given it away. We've turned our backs on the lion and we don't fear it. Well, it's okay to face the lion if you're prepared, but you can't just stand there with your back to him and expect that he might not take a swipe or finish you off as a snack.
It's curious to me is why countries and people and everybody continues to buy these treasury bonds. I saw that, what did they do? $25 billion in 3 years treasury notes yesterday or the day before. And, you know, it wasn't like a sale at Macy's, but, you know, people bought them.
Because they are the equivalent of money.
Yeah, they're the best thing money is.
They're
money
the equivalent
right
of money. You go to a bank and you say, I have this three-year treasury note, and you pledge it to them.
Yeah, they'll like it.
They'll loan
it,
you 98% of that. No, you know, hey, here you go.
Really?
Here's your money back.
So you can take a three-year treasury, go to Chase Bank, and borrow dollars if you give them that thing?
Yeah, excuse me, sulfur.
Sulfur time. See, Andy's just taking a
bite of sulfur. Sorry, sorry. You can pledge it as collateral.
Oh, so you can actually monetize that yourself?
Correct.
Well, that's pretty good. So you can play like the big boys. You can monetize your thing. Right?
Yeah, let's say you have $1 million, extra $1 million.
Yeah, nothing.
So you buy $1 million treasury bond.
Mm-hmm. At what percent?
And somebody has told you, oh, by the way, interest rates are going to go down, guaranteed. So anyway.
Yeah, but that's not true.
You're convinced you want this, so you go to the bank, you buy a treasury bill bond note, and you pledge it for a loan. Then you take that money and do the same thing again. And in this way, you can take $1 million and end up with $1 billion worth of treasury debt using leverage.
That's legal.
You borrowed the money, yeah.
That's legal. And you know what?
So imagine that in the organized market, and those are derivatives. Now, amplify that by the program traders times the greedy number of day traders. Forgive me, Scott, I'm not talking about you. Mm-hmm. The guys who make a living doing this sort of thing. And they take risk on top of risk, and all of it is done in our name because we're the ultimate recipients and users of dollars.
And, you know, to add insult to injury when it comes to the Federal Reserve Bank and who owns it, and one of the primaries you taught us is Goldman Sachs, also known as Goldman My Slacks, former Mnuchin, Paulson, Geithner.
Everybody
there, right?
Right.
Well, it turns out that you just can't, they just don't do the deal between Treasury, as you taught us, between Treasury and the Fed. Right. You got to have a dealer. 22
primary market makers,
and they actually get a cut on all this. So they get a cut two times.
Yeah, they get first shot at any Treasury bill, bond, or note being issued by the Treasury.
And then they'll resell it.
Well, of course.
Yeah. So
or
you know,
pledge it.
Check
or,
this out. Did you know in the last 7 years, Goldman My Slacks, they managed somehow to get
buy
them all. Did you see that? I mean, almost buy them all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, come on.
Yeah.
There's no accident there. How did that happen?
Hey,
are they that strong?
They were the best bidders.
Goldman My Slacks. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, no. Goldman is a very powerful company, man. As is J.P. Morgan Chase.
Sure.
As is Bank of America.
But it seems like Goldman at the top of the food chain.
Yeah.
Pretty much,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they have been for the longest time.
Yeah. Well, how far back do they go? Where
1869.
Oh, good.
We talked about that discount, the discount market, right?
Yeah, 1869. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And who started that? Some dude named Goldman?
Samuel Goldman.
And who was Sachs?
Yeah, well, they're another family, the mm-hmm. partner family. And the original owners of the Fed, this is where these shares have accumulated, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if you, Eustace Mullins' chart used to float around the internet, everybody claimed it as their own without credit mm-hmm. To Mr. Mullins. Mm-hmm. But the original chart that you see would show that the Lehman Brothers.
Is that the one we have on our site that you made
no,
up for
that,
us?
No, that's much more modern.
More modern. We have it on our site.
That's Andy Goss research.
Right.
But Mr. Mullins originally, long before the internet, had looked at who were the subscribers, who were the banks in the districts that bought these shares when the charter was first issued to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. 14, yeah. Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Right.
And... yeah, he found the families and tied their links so that essentially what you had was that just like the first bank of the United States, right, was the forerunner.
1793?
Two. Close.
Man,
you're all over this.
I get close.
But there you see Alexander Hamilton mm-hmm. and his partner. Mm-hmm. You see Robert Morris and Thomas Willing. And, the people that were associated with Hamilton, it was Hamilton who put Morris up for the job of superintendent of finance when he wrote a letter to Silas Dean and said, oh, I know this great guy in Philly that would be great as superintendent of our finance for the revolution. And, of course, it was Robert Morris, and that was the Bank of North America. And it literally took them 2 years to reveal the chicanery. And they said, no, that's it. You're done. 2 years. And so then we went without a central bank effectively until Alexander Hamilton talked George Washington into doing it against the advice of those who had witnessed the machinations of Morris and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Willing and the crowd, which was the Philadelphia crowd, Pennsylvania being the strongest legislature in that area. And curiously, I find names in there like... when they were debating whether or not to even do this thing, you have people from Boston. You have Samuel Adams. You have John Adams. But, these guys are down here talking to the Philadelphia legislature. So
they're right in there.
And all of them financed by this very curious person named Chaim Solomon, who was on a prison ship, according to records, 2 years before. So somehow he got access to an enormous pile of money and used it to fund the revolutionaries who would later become the forefathers of our country. And incidentally, at the same time, managed to secure a franchise. Although Chaim Solomon's fingerprints are not on the franchise, I suspect that he was an agent for the pile that was used to finance the revolution. He's in everything I find. When George Washington needed money to cross the Delaware and attack the Hessians, Solomon provided. And so much money that without him, they've called him the financier of the American Revolution, without him and his unknown source of cash, there would have been no revolution. There was no commerce they needed hard money. I mean, the continental dollar, you've heard the phrase, not worth a continental. So at the founding of the Republic, there was subterfuge to get the private ownership of the central bank. And that was done in 92. It was redone in 1812, even after a little skirmish. It expired.
Called the War of 1812.
Right. It took Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, to finally kill it pretty good so that it didn't reemerge until the Civil War. And part of the thesis there is that the Civil War was provoked by agent provocateurs that, funded and financed the abolitionists. Not that they didn't have good hearts, but any division that could be fostered between the states was done to the highest extent. Mm-hmm. And while we're on that, just for a moment, you heard Donald Trump talk about Andrew Jackson would have prevented the Civil War, right?
Yes.
Well, he did. He did, in his showdown with John C. Calhoun over nullification. And if Jackson hadn't backed down and said, okay, you're right, you can nullify the tariff, then we would have been at war right then. The South was ready to secede right then and there. And it was only that Andrew Jackson paid nod to the Constitution and says, all right, the states have the ultimate rights. We're just the central federal government. We really have no authority over South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so we're backing down. Mm-hmm. Whereas Abe Lincoln said, oh, the hell with that. We're superior to the states. We're the Union. And that's more important than the states' rights. And so we're going to war. And I think President Trump is correct. If Jackson would have been in power, he would have prevented the Civil War. He would not have gone to war over the right of a state to secede from the Union.
He would have let them.
Yeah, or he would have figured out why they want to do that. What is it that makes you want to do that? Yeah.
The art of the deal. He would have done
Amen.
It. Yeah.
Amen.
About 10 years ago, Andrew put together a Federal Reserve Bank of New York Capital Stock Master Report. And if you just put in the One Radio Network search engine, who owns the Fed, it comes right up. We'll put a hot link in today's show so you could take a look at it. Now, as I look at this, and this is 10 years old, it doesn't look like, Andrew, according to this, that Goldman is really at top of the food chain here.
That's
with all
right.
These numbers. Why is that?
Well, because of all the subsidiary arrangements. And,
because you
and
just don't know.
Ownership and control are two entirely different things.
Gotcha.
So the chart there is to prove that there's a lot of people involved.
Boy, there's huge amount of people.
Okay.
But
right?
Who knows who owns it and who's got the
that's
stock?
A long list. Right. Who really owns that entity? Now you drill down into, okay, who owns this Bank B?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what do you know? They have, and this is another great Mullins research piece, interlocking directorships among the major corporations.
Yeah.
And he uses a Senate report that you can get. You know, the Senate actually studied this, the idea that you interlock directorships so you control more than one company.
So, for example, one of the big players, according to this number, is MIZUMO Corporate Bank. It's a USA bank, right?
Yes, but obviously Japanese.
Japanese, right. Pretty huge holdings.
Correct.
But you just don't know who owns it or who's controlling it.
Yeah, you have
it.
To drill down into Japan and say, well, what happened after World War II?
Mm-hmm.
And who took over and took control of the Japanese economy? And, you know, what did they evolve into? And then how did they become a player in the U.S. market?
And what's curious about this, there's no way, well, there would be a way, but it would be virtually impossible to really drill down and look at these old 400-year-old wooden file cabinet somewhere up in
right.
The ark and you see all the, oh, look at this, Uncle George owns, you know,
yeah.
this, and this
well,
goes
yeah.
to the Kennedy family, or
and
who
the
knows?
Stillmans, yeah.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
and
yeah.
I did find in the Library Company of Philadelphia, curiously,
yeah. Yeah.
Some of the original records for the first bank of the United States.
Wow.
But you know, that's what you find, that the
sure.
that the original owners, and you know, again, I pose this question, if you're an original owner, you're not going to dilute out your control. You're simply going to increase it. And that's what's been
and
done.
And whether they're passed down from family to family.
Right.
So this
or
is
bought out in corporate takeovers. Like if you follow that number one charter to J.P. Morgan Chase, you'll see, well, if I say this phrase, the wave of bank mergers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mergers and acquisitions. And I, you know, just in my 30 years, I've witnessed. So we had a local bank called Citizens First National Bank, which was bought out by Fleet, which was bought out by Norwest, which was bought out by Bank of America. So they kind of rolled everything up into one holding company. But the components sometimes disappear and sometimes are left in place. This is another thing, by the way, the idea of the separation between commercial banks and investment banks. That is a relatively new phenomenon, the idea
yeah,
that
late
these,
90s, right?
Right. They should all be together. So if you're alive today and you let's say you've been alive 50 years, you've witnessed some dramatic financial history that, I mean, it's like you were there at the event, so to speak. And future historians will look back at the period and say, well, this is when we did this first experiment where we took the peg off the dollar and we didn't back it with gold anymore. And look, this is what happened in the 30 years or 40 years or 50 years after that. And this is why we do it this way today. Mm-hmm. Right? So,
yeah.
I mean, you saw the closing of the gold window in 1971. You saw monetary decontrol in 1980, where the Federal Reserve was then given the power to monetize any debt instrument, and now you're witnessing the explosion of the balance sheet after they've consolidated the other players. So, you know, in the time when they were given this monetary power to create to monetize debt instruments, they still hadn't consolidated the rest of the world. And it wasn't until 1999 with the formation of the euro did the problem become manageable. And I believe it was intended to be a trilateral plan, with Japan being the third leg in that Asian tiger market. But it was 97 when the Asian tigers kind of imploded and China took the center stage. Again, I don't think an accident. Their currency just got stronger and they became the Asian leg of the SDR issued by the IMF. So this dollar, euro, yuan triumvirate will ultimately control the entirety of the world's finances.
Mm-hmm. So can we conjecture from that? There's a pretty good chance that China is not going to be blowing up the United States anytime soon, or vice versa.
Guaranteed.
Because, I mean, why would you do that? These are your boys. These are your buddies.
We're Swiss, man.
Yeah, these are your guys. Now, maybe, though, you know, the whole North Korea thing, maybe there's some substance to this, but I kind of get the feeling this is all just fear stuff, too, but I don't
know. They do cooperate, but they might fight each other over that last cannoli. You know,
Oh, I see. Cannoli, yeah.
Yeah, and the rest of the crowd will watch.
That's mine.
My cannoli. Slap.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you might see some of that, but, mm-hmm. you know, the idea that they're going to upturn the banquet table and, you know, cause discomfort for everybody else. No, it's why that list is so long. It's what Alexander Hamilton preached to his partners in private. Look, the more people we involve, the better chance we have of succeeding. Hmm. This idea that one person or one entity could do it makes them a target and the enemy of everybody else. But if you involve everyone, you don't leave anyone out. You bring everyone in under the tent, then they're all going to cooperate to make sure that the system perpetuates.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, too.
Yeah.
So you get people out there and they talk about the Rothschilds, but that's just a big name that everybody knows that you can pick on them. But
sure.
Who knows? You know,
Macron.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a Rothschild.
Yeah. Macron's a Rothschild?
Absolutely.
Oh, boy, no surprise.
Absolutely. What do they call him? An investment banker.
Oh.
He's an investment banker. Mm.
Okay, we need to take a little break here since we're about 30 minutes overboard, but I like to do that. Boy, what fun this hour was. I hope you learn as much as I do during the Real World of Money every Wednesday. It's really fascinating for me. Hope it is for you, too. Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, please pass on these podcasts to everybody that you care about. We've talked about these products that are Nature's Pure Organics, and I'd like to give you a little plug for Gary Hanna and what he's doing there. I met with him again the other day, and I bought some 6,000 parts per million colloidal silver, a monoatomic. I don't even know what I'm going to do with it. I mean, something like that would probably chase away the plague. You know, it's a lot. You don't really need that much. He was suggesting that I could, if I wanted to, maybe nebulize some silver, say put a little bit of silver, some 3% hydrogen peroxide in a nebulizer, he said you could get it down to about 1,000. He said, man, that'd be a lot. You know, that'd be a lot. You don't even need that much since I have my lungs are perfectly fine. But, you know, you could go in there and have some fun and see how it feels and just keep anybody that's in there trying to set up housekeeping, if there is anybody. And I tell you, I did some the other night, but I diluted to about. So the cool thing is, if you wanted to get some really strong, you don't have to, but you could. And, you know, you could talk to Gary, and then you can dilute it yourself with just some, distilled water and just dilute it 6 to 1, and you got 1,000 parts per million. It's that simple, and it could actually save money doing it that way if you wanted to buy. But these are 99.999% pure silver. It's the real deal. This is monoatomic, single atoms particles, much smaller than nanoparticles. Unlike some people that claim that they're all nano, not true. This is the real deal. He's using technology that, well, people have tried to buy it from him, and he's figured this out. He's quite an engineer. His dad was Texas Instruments, which I think bought out, had a lot of the Tesla stuff. Somehow they ended up with a lot of the Tesla material at Texas Instruments, and his dad worked that. And he got a lot of stuff from that. Pretty cool history. You can listen to the interview with Gary Hanna. But anyway, it's Nature's Pure Organics. You can get monoatomic silver, gold, copper, also selenium, and some really, really fine clay that we like a lot. There's 5 blend clay that I've been taking that's really, really cool. It's a great company. He's in Austin. You could just call him. I think he's got his phone number there, or send him an email. Let's see. Does he have his phone number? Yeah, he's got his phone number right there. Right there. And if you go to Nature's Pure Organics, and he's got his phone number there, and check out some of his products. Think you'll like it.
In this country, the sulfur levels have been dropping. There was an alarm that went out to the Congress, and this was in 1932 or 34 when this big warning came out. Mineral quantities have been dropping in the U.S. for quite a while, and especially as farmland got worn out. Notable of things was the sulfur, and if you had been eating high sulfur foods all of your life, you may be getting enough sulfur, but we're not. And the sulfur content in foods is way low, and really, you need sulfur. The number one thing that sulfur does is it detoxifies the cells.
Thank you, George. George Altgeld on a previous show. He's a biologist, chemist, and knows a lot about agriculture. The number one thing, he says, is sulfur detoxifies the cells. This is pure sulfur. Very few of them are. 3 prices, 3 locations, United States, Canada, and worldwide. Click an order. See the ad right-hand side on oneradionetwork.com. We are going to talk with Judy Hoy next week. She's up in Montana. She's done quite a bit of research and published papers on the glyphosate sulfur connection, and also the glyphosate GMO grains, what it's doing to people, and it's got some real interesting numbers. And she also sees it where it's happening in the animals, because she's like this animal rescue person, right? So she's always getting animals. And she's actually seeing how it's affecting the animals as they're getting, they get into GMO corn up there. They get all kinds of, and it's just really interesting what it's doing to the structure of the animal's mouth and things like that at the very beginning of their birthing kind of thing, the first few weeks. And she's been able to help them with just getting some more minerals and sulfur in there. She'll be here next week. This really pretty interesting product, sulfur. People love it. And we had a gentleman on yesterday who was a big sulfur fan as well. So you can listen to that show with his name somewhere. So anyway, try it if you like. 3 prices, 3 locations, United States, Canada, worldwide. If you like more than 4 pounds, simply email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Alan wrote in this morning, "I'm all out of sulfur. I need my fix. What's the discounted price for 9 pounds? I believe it's at the amount I ordered last time. 9 pounds at a time, some people get. You can chip in with your neighbors and get a whole bunch and then get a 15% discount. And we put it all in one box, so you really save on shipping as well. Patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
We hope you're enjoying the program on oneradionetwork.com with Andy Goss and Patrick Timpone. For those of you interested in acquiring gold and silver coins, SDL Incorporated at 1-800-878-2646 is providing information for investors who would love to learn about how to properly acquire United States gold and silver coins. Call us today for free information, 1-800-878-2646, and learn how to incorporate gold and silver coins into your personal portfolio. USGoldCoins.com, 1-800-878-2646.
Andrew Goss, so, you know, Fred there, your partner Fred, said that people can get information and stuff like that. So what else do you offer other than somebody on the phone saying, hey, man, you want to buy this coin? Send me a check for $10,000.
That's it.
You know what I'm saying?
No, we books. Goodness, I'm trying to think of everything.
Got your CDs, right?
Yeah. The CDs are probably our number one giveaway. People like to listen. And this one is 3 half-hour audio CDs that explain. One is the definition of money. What the heck is a dollar anyway? The other is the Federal Reserve. What does it do? How does it operate, et cetera? And then the third, protecting your wealth. That one, it deals strictly with the issue of coins, how to do it, you know, how not to do it, et cetera. So you can get all of those free by just mentioning that you heard it on One Radio Network, Patrick Timpone, and call 800-468-2646. One thing you won't get is people hounding you with high pressure to buy gold coins. That's taboo around here.
We just man, that's what's fun when somebody calls you at 8 o'clock.
You got to buy
night.
This. So.
8 o'clock at night. Hey, I just got a deal. Jeez. You guys
not well, not unless you ask for that. You know, we do have people that really want first shot at everything. And when you're dealing
with your list, right?
Yes. And when you're dealing with a fixed supply market, understand, you know, I recommend the Hawaiian half dollar.
Oh, I want one of those.
I think the Hawaiian half dollar from the early 20th century is a great coin to own, very low mintage, and certainly very desirable.
Too.
But don't call me and ask to buy one, because if it was such a great investment, I wouldn't have one. That's basically how it goes. You know, if anything that's good and that's scarce and that's good to own is not common. You can't buy a bunch of them.
Where do you find all these?
Well, I go to estate sales and auctions. I talk to people that I've already sold the coins to at some point in the past, and I try to get them back. But, you know, again, they don't make them anymore. There's just nowhere to get them unless you buy them from somebody who already has it put away.
I see. It's pretty fun, pretty fun, pretty fun. 800-468-2646.